Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's program:
Peshawi is still in Jordan, the exchange will happen once we receive the proof of life that we asked for. Then we can proceed with the next step that we announced yesterday.
Jordan says it's ready to exchange a failed suicide bomber when it has proof that a pilot being held by Islamic State is alive. Meanwhile, the wife of a Japanese journalist being held by IS begs for his release. Samira Shackle and Dr. James Boyes are in the studio to pick apart a crisis embroiling Jordan and Japan. Also on today's agenda, Iran selects a new envoy to the UN months after the US rejected its first choice. And Thor or no Thor, Cuba asks America to give back Guantanamo Bay. We'll look at how normal this normalization is currently looking. Also up ahead:
it does stand out in terms of the way it looks at stories, very American way. The way the writing is and the design, you can feel that this is not the typical traditional Chinese publication.
We take a look at the weekly printed press in China with our guest Patrick Bowler, visit a new exhibition chronicling the Palestinian refugee experience, and review the week in books. All that and some music as well coming up on Midori House right now on Monocle 24. An action-packed 58 minutes ahead of us as ever, but before all that, Paul Osborne has the latest world news.
Officials in Jordan say they are ready to release an Iraqi terror suspect in return for a Jordanian pilot who is being held by Islamic State militants. Muaz al-Kasasbeh was captured in December when his plane crashed in Syria during a bombing raid targeting IS. It is also holding the Japanese journalist Kenji Goto, whose wife has appealed to the governments in both Japan and Jordan to save the lives of the two men. Rinko Goto says her husband travelled to Syria to help the country's people.
I beg the Jordanian and Japanese government to understand that the fate of both men are in their hands. I thank the governments of Jordan and Japan for all their efforts. I pray for the life of my husband and the Jordanian pilot.
Officials in Malaysia have formally declared the loss of a passenger jet almost a year ago to be an accident. 239 people were on board Malaysia Airlines Flight 370, which disappeared after taking off from Kuala Lumpur for Beijing. Azharuddin Abdul Rahman is in charge of Malaysia's Department of Civil Aviation.
We officially declare Malaysia Airlines Flight MH370 an accident, and that all 239 of the passengers and crew on board are presumed to have lost their lives.
That announcement clears the way for compensation payments to the relatives of those on board the plane. The funeral is taking place today in Buenos Aires of Alberto Nisman, the Argentinian prosecutor who was found dead in his home hours before he was due to give potentially explosive evidence. He had been investigating a bomb attack in the city more than 20 years ago in which more than 80 people died, and it was thought that he would accuse Argentina's president, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, of involvement in a plot to conceal alleged Iranian involvement in the attack. Prosecutors are yet to establish whether Nisman was murdered or took his own life. At least 7 people have been killed and more than 50 others have been injured in an explosion at a maternity hospital in Mexico City. 3 of the victims are children. It happened when a gas truck blew up outside, badly damaging the hospital in the west of the city. Rescue workers are picking through the rubble, searching for survivors. EU foreign ministers have been meeting in Brussels, discussing whether to impose further sanctions on Russia over its role in the crisis in Ukraine. It follows last weekend's attack on the port of Mariupol, in which at least 30 people were killed. Russia continues to deny any direct involvement in the violence in the east of Ukraine, but says that what it calls Russian volunteers are fighting there. Ukraine's foreign minister Pavlo Klimkin has accused Moscow of deliberately hampering a peace plan.
We have clear understanding that another heinous terrorist act could bring about the whole spiral of violence in a totally different direction. So I understand that the ministers are ready to prepare bold and robust statement about supporting Ukraine.
The militant group Hezbollah has apparently told Israel it does not want a full-scale conflict on the Lebanese border. It follows clashes on Wednesday in which two Israeli soldiers and a UN peacekeeper were killed. A message apparently passed through a UN mission appears to be an attempt to calm the situation, but Israel says it remains prepared to deal with any further attacks. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. It's 18:06 in London, which will be 13:06 in New York City. Joining me now with their take on today's news here in the studio, we have the journalist Samira Shackle and the political historian Dr. James Boyes, US policy expert and author of Clinton's Grand Strategy. Welcome both. Now, the sun set over Syria a little over 2 hours ago, and with it elapsed the deadline apparently issued by Islamic State yesterday for the release of an Iraqi terrorist on death row in Jordan, without which they threatened to execute Lieutenant Moaz al-Kazazbe, a Jordanian fighter pilot held since his F-16 came down on IS territory in December. Jordan had earlier offered to free failed suicide bomber Sajida al-Rashawi, but was seeking confirmation of Lieutenant al-Kazazbe's well-being. The fate of a Japanese hostage, Kenji Goto, who has been used by IS as a conduit, remains somewhat unclear. Samir, I'll ask you first, is there the remotest chance of this ending well, do we think?
There's not a good track record on it, really, is there? ISIS, whatever you want to call them, has a track record of immense brutality when it comes to hostages. But I mean, there are, I think, the ones that we haven't heard about so much in the press are the ones who have been freed when ransoms have been paid. And so I think there was a hostage recently who was Italian. There's also been hostages from France who've been released when on the payment of enormous sums of money. So there have been times when deals have been struck, basically. But those deals did, I think, happen slightly more behind closed doors. It became less of a sort of public political positioning bargaining chip.
Well, James, that's where I wanted to bring you in, because the two oddities have struck me here. One has been the Jordanian government's willingness to conduct this negotiation in public, or at least conduct a form of the negotiation in public. Lord knows what is being said or done in back channels. But also the way that the stakes have altered. First, Islamic State wanted $200 million, which is obviously a lot of money. Now they seem content to exchange an incompetent suicide bomber for an F-16 pilot, which seems like a poor bargain, doesn't it?
It does indeed. You're absolutely right. I mean, the question here is, you know, have you got a twin-track approach? Almost certainly. So there are public negotiations going on. What else is going on behind closed doors? It's fascinating that Jordan, which of course is very closely tied with the US and sort of Western interests in that part of the world, is willing, it would seem, to negotiate and enter into a negotiation with IS, considering the fact that historically, of course, you know, the sort of the pro-Western perspective is we don't negotiate with terrorists, etc., etc., etc. So it will be fascinating to see what comes of this. It's great that obviously Samir has brought up this idea that some people have been released, and that hasn't really got an awful lot of media attention. But when you look at, you know, some of the demands ISIS have made, you know, for example, convert and thou shalt be saved, and then that of course hasn't saved these individuals and they've met this terrible, terrible fate. You know, one really must question the degree to which these people can be seen to negotiate in good faith.
Samira, it is obviously something of a fool's errand trying to assess the logic, as at least as it seems to Islamic State, in many of their actions. But one thought that occurred to me at least was, In dropping the demand for money and offering to conduct a prisoner exchange, which is the sort of thing that adversaries at war do all the time, are Islamic State, is it possible Islamic State are seeking some sort of pattern of legitimacy for themselves, that they're trying to act like an actual country?
It's possible. I think it's also possible that as a sort of slightly more cynical motive, I mean, as you've said, obviously it has to be speculation, but it's also possible, I think, that the power of these continued beheadings, demands for money and so on is just sort of diminishing. It doesn't seem like now anyone's going to give money. Even governments who would previously give money in return for hostages are not, have sort of publicly
said it is weren't. A horrible thought that we've become just terribly blasé now about but hostages getting beheaded. But I think you might be right.
Yeah, I think it is. It's. I think perhaps not as simple as you know, people getting blasé, but it is a horrible fact that you know, publics get bored of the same media story. And I think ISIS is an intensely media aware organization, perhaps more than any other terror organization we've ever seen. So I think that it's possible that, you know, it's just a way of changing tack and sort of gaining something from these hostages who they've still got by sort of continuing to be surprising and to I think to try and set the terms of the narrative and not allow their Western adversaries or regional adversaries to do so.
If Jordan, James, are prepared to, or indeed if they do enact this prisoner exchange, how is that likely to play with their coalition partners, especially those, the US, UK, who at least in public take a very hard line on such things, although, of course, it's not that long since the US gave up a bunch of Taliban prisoners to get Sergeant Bo Bergdahl back?
Yeah, that's very, very true. I think it will sit difficultly with them, quite frankly. It's not something that the West really wants to encourage in any way, shape or form. You know, if you take a very hard line and say, right, that's it, we have a strict policy, no negotiation effectively with terrorists, full stop, then, you know, you've got a high watermark, you can adhere to it. The problem is that it's very easy to say that in public, but, you know, all too often, as you rightly allude to, these positions are sort of lost when you get into the negotiation tactics and people have been released on a regular basis. So I think one of the challenges here is coming back to your original point, that whilst there is a public position going on here from Jordan, what you'll be fascinating to see is what's going on behind closed doors. I thought it was fascinating, this idea of if you don't want 200 million anymore, but you're prepared to swap for an individual, you know, what does that say about their finances, quite frankly? You know, and do they, if they need the idea of publicity more than $200 million, I think that probably speaks quite volumes to the extent of their power and where they're getting money from, perhaps at this point as well.
Samira, you were talking there, and you're quite right in that up to this point, Islamic State, ghastly though they are, have on their own merits shown themselves extremely astute judges of how to play the media, what makes a story and what doesn't. The thing James mentioned there, the idea that they wanted $200 million and decided they didn't want $200 million, what they wanted was this slightly obscure and incompetent terrorist released from death row in Jordan. Is it possible to discern which audience they think they're playing to at this point? Who are they trying to impress with that manoeuvre?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, that. Something I was reading was saying that this suicide bomber who failed in her mission, as you said, was from a 2005 attack in Jordan, which was sort of quite broadly judged to be a massive disaster for the group that sort of later became ISIS. So it could be a sort of attempt to claw back something, some sort of save face from that incident. It's hard to say, really. I think that they're constantly appealing to different audiences at different levels, to the international audience, and as we know, there's, you know, the big story has been about foreign fighters who continue to flow there. I think there's also a sense of playing to local audiences, perhaps, because they do ultimately need at least the tacit support of some local communities and the areas they control and so on. So yeah, I think it's interesting. And I think it's also interesting, just to pick up on something that James said about how certain governments take a very, very strong line on hostage negotiations. And I think this idea that we will not negotiate with terrorists, we'll make no concessions to terrorists, is a very appealing one in theory. But in practice, it's actually not particularly productive, because, you know, if in negotiating with terrorists, you're not necessarily saying that you will make concessions. But I think that process of dialogue is always a useful one. And I think sort of taking a resolutely firm line on it, it's a very unpleasant business, and I think it's always going to involve unpleasant compromises. But I think taking a very resolutely, absolutely no negotiation line can lead to sort of huge tragedy that could possibly be avoided.
Just a final thought on that, James. We were talking earlier about the twin-track approach, which is almost certainly going on. And as Samira noted, governments are forever you know, being very hardline about not negotiating with terrorists, whereas, of course, they almost invariably do. The British government, for all the decades of the Troubles in Ireland, was saying it doesn't negotiate with terrorists, and they had been negotiating with the IRA since the late 60s. Is it possible, though, that in this age of modern communication, social media, that it's not possible to sustain a twin-track thing anymore because everybody finds out everything so quickly?
There's no doubt about it that the time lag between an event occurring and public perception of it and understanding of it has certainly been massively truncated. But I think that a twin-track approach within diplomacy and negotiations will always be required, quite frankly, because there is this need, I think, to have the public face the stated policy, which serves a political purpose, whilst you can have a policy purpose which undercuts all that and can actually run counter to that. And that's something I think that all too often the public isn't necessarily aware of or comprehends.
Okay, well, we'll move along now to what is hopefully more hopeful diplomatic news. Iran has a new permanent representative at the United Nations. Now, this is not a reason to stop the presses in and of itself, because countries appoint new UN representatives all the time, and indeed Iran has appointed this one before. But Gholam Ali Khosrou, who is currently Tehran's man in Bern, is the Islamic Republic's second choice. Their first, Hamid Abutalebi, was denied a visa by the US, who weren't willing to see past the minor role he played in the 1979 hostage crisis, in which 52 Americans were held in Iran for 444 days. James, this is just a pet suspicion of mine I want to try out on you. Why did the Iranians nominate Abutalebi in the first place? Were they trying to be funny?
Well, I've always been a fan of Iranian humour, so I think maybe you're absolutely right with regard to that. But I think they were pushing to see what the Obama administration would do with regards to it. I think what it does demonstrate is that whether they be Republican or Democrat, the Americans take a hard line with regard to this. It's important to remember, of course, don't forget also that it was a Democratic administration that was forced from office because of the Iranian crisis back with Jimmy Carter's day. So, that, you know, Iran is the bete noire of Democrats as much as Iraq is with regard to the Republicans to an extent. It's good that we've moved beyond this because, quite frankly, it was a rather embarrassing diplomatic standoff. And at the moment, of course, don't forget the Obama administration is being seen to be particularly warm towards Iranian negotiations. And from a Republican standpoint, they're often being attacked for being too soft. So it'll be interesting to see whether this helps with those nuclear confrontational talks which are ongoing at this time.
Samira, it was nonetheless the first time the US, which is, of course, the host of the United Nations, has ever denied a visa for a UN representative. And obviously, in the decades that the UN has been in New York City, they have waived any number of rum customers into their country on that basis. Why do you think America is, I mean, James enumerated some of the reasons there, but why is America still so touchy about 1979?
Yeah, it's an interesting point that, and I think, and it's interesting that I think this is something that the Iranian government is planning to pursue. The fact that I think their claim is that in denying a visa, the US was dictating who a foreign state could have as their representative at the UN, which is quite an interesting sort of wrangling around the international
law. And
it's
clearly exactly what America were doing.
Yeah, exactly. Which is, I think, illegal under international law and under the terms of the treaty they signed up to when the UN was going to be based there. So, yeah, it's interesting. I think there's certain events, I suppose, in different countries' histories which just retain a very central point of their psyche. And I think that the hostage crisis in Iran was one of them. And I think particularly for America, there's a sense of when they are just sort of being wrong-footed and so on. And it's not as if that was an isolated incident. That sort of came alongside decades of animosity. So it's not an incident in isolation. But I do think it's an incident with particular resonance when there's such an emphasis put on America's ability to not just export democracy, but to, you know, it sort of protect its own citizens. And it was a case when clearly for 444 days, whatever it was, that wasn't possible.
James, is it possible to frame this, or would it be over-optimistic to frame this as potentially another small step in a general rapprochement between the United States and Iran? Because they have recently been forced into a sort of weird enemy of my enemy embrace over Islamic State. This situation can surely not continue forever. It is one of those standoffs that starts to look more and more preposterous with every year that passes.
It does. And I think you could put the situation with Cuba in that same category. I mean, that went on for, 50 years.
We're
going
to
talk about that shortly. But I've heard be on the grapevine that there are apparently optimistic signs coming out of the White House with regard to its moves with regard to Iran. I've not been a strong supporter of this administration, but I think it's possible to see, possibly, that the last 18 months of this administration could very well see two groundbreaking breakthroughs with regard to US foreign policy, the rapprochement with Cuba and, who knows, some moves with regard to Iran. I think it's very much within the White House's interest, both personally, for the individuals involved, and from an attempt to get its own legacy sorted out, that it can do so. And I think if it could turn around and say, look, we've sorted out the situation with Cuba, we've stabilised relations with Iran, then that would be a very, very successful foreign policy agenda for any administration, especially one having basically squeezed into the last 18 months of its term in office.
We will be discussing Cuba in greater detail shortly. Right now, we're going to take a brief break. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Samira Shackle and James Boyes. When we return, we will be asking whether those supposedly thawing Cuba-US relations are heading back into the freezer. And we'll be looking to South Africa and asking, would you want to live on a street named after F.W. de Klerk?
Global affairs, culture, business, design or urbanism. At Monocle 24, we've got it covered. And when it comes to transport and travel, you need look no further. From automobile innovators to the creative minds shaping the in-flight experience, we speak to the experts to ensure you have all the industry news you'll ever need. In New York, our transport editor, Tristan McAllister.
Whether it's a closer look at the global aviation heavyweights or embedding with the people who keep Alaska State Ferry System afloat, we take you to the people and the places that make our world move.
Take to the skies, the rails, the seas or the roads with Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me, Samira Shackle and James Boyes. Now, while we probably are still a fair stretch from the reopening of America's embassy in Tehran, as of a few weeks ago, we were supposed to be a good deal closer to a normalization of relations between Washington and Havana. President Barack Obama's admission of the self-defeating absurdity of his country's decades-long blockade of Cuba was as accurate as it was overdue. However, the negotiations over the detail were never going to be easy, and Cuba has started with a somewhat audacious opening bid, saying it wants Guantanamo Bay back. Samira Shackle, Guantanamo Bay was leased to the US by a very previous administration in Cuba in 1903, in fact. Is this likely to happen, or is Cuba just asking for something they know they're not going to get in the hope of bargaining America down?
Well, I mean, Obama's been trying to get rid of Guantanamo for ages and hasn't been able to, so I think that, I don't know. I think I think certainly the tactic of Cuba's statements today seems to be sort of aimed very high at the outset. They've also demanded to be taken off the America's very short list of states which sponsor international terrorism. I was quite interested to see that it's I think there's only four states on the list: Iran, Cuba, Syria, and Sudan. So they also want to be taken off that list. But I think the Guantanamo question is quite interesting just because of the logistical difficulties of it. I mean, the fact is that the prison has been, even apart from the territorial issues which were raised by the Cuban negotiating team today, there's just such issues with closing the prison because no one wants to take the prisoners. They're sort of essentially stateless.
Yeah, I think one of the important things to realise here is we're not just talking about the prison. This is a huge naval base. This is a territorial possession for the United States. It's a huge staging base for its fleet on some occasions. It's a massive geopolitical status about US positioning with regard to the Caribbean. It enables the United States to police the Caribbean. This is not a territory, a possession that the Obama administration is going to surrender. Full stop.
But just staying on that point, James, the thing that I'm wondering is how strong a negotiating position Havana is really in. I mean, can't the US just say, like, we could just wait for you two to die?
Yes, absolutely. There's no doubt about it. Let's not kid ourselves here. You know, the Castro brothers are not getting any younger. The only danger here, frankly, is if the Castro brothers think, well, we can outweigh Obama. The trouble then, of course, is if, heaven forbid, the Republicans were to win the presidency from the viewpoint of this deal.
President Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio.
Well, exactly. You know, neither of whom are going to roll over and play ball with the Castros, effectively. So, you know, they are playing a dangerous game. They are never going to get a better deal, frankly, than they will from the current occupant of the White House. So if they play silly buggers and basically throw this into the long grass, effectively, you know, they could very well scupper the deal that Obama desperately wants to get secured for his own legacy.
Just a final thought on that, Samira. Is that the state? Well, is that, I guess, the ace up the Cuban sleeve, the potential embarrassment to Barack Obama if this doesn't happen?
I suppose so, but you'd like to think that the potential benefits to them are greater. But I suppose that's always the case, isn't it? If there's something that a leader, an individual or a regime is clearly staking something as subjective as and sort of personally important as legacy on, that I think that can be exploited by the other side. But you'd think that the concrete benefits to Cubans would be preferable. And, you know, as those Republican senators who James mentioned who are opposing the deal, their argument is that in the economic benefits it'll bring, it could end up really sort of bolstering the Castro regime. So I think that will probably be a consideration too from their perspective.
Well, finally tonight, in most circumstances, the decision to name a street after a local winner of the Nobel Peace Prize would seem about the least controversial one that any local authority could take. Not so in Cape Town, where the renaming of a stretch of highway after F.W. de Klerk, the last apartheid-era president of South Africa, has not met with universal acclaim. Samira, naming things after people, especially when they're still alive and so are the memories, is always a bit politically fraught. I'm reminded at this point of, I think, my favourite ever Iranian diplomatic initiative, which was, of course, renaming the street on which the British Embassy was. It was named Winston Churchill Boulevard in 1981. They renamed it after Bobby Sands. Is this the kind of thing we should just leave until after people are long dead if we want to name something after them?
Yeah, I do think that's probably a good idea for the most part. I sort of think in this instance it's a really interesting case because yes, he did win the Nobel Peace Prize, and it's certainly true. I think that, you know, he and Mandela won it jointly.
Indeed.
He was the last apartheid president. He was in huge part responsible for the ending of apartheid. But I think that one of the things about the process of dismantling apartheid that was so impressive, I think, obviously lots of things have gone wrong since, but one of the things that was very impressive was the emphasis on reconciliation. And I think that in taking a very controversial move now at a time when the situation in the country at large isn't that good, when the Rainbow Nation hasn't really quite emerged, I think it's unnecessarily provocative. There's no reason not to wait.
I mean, I don't want to write the guy's obituary yet. He is only 78 and in reasonably good health as far as it's possible to tell. But is de Klerk, will he be remembered, should he be remembered as basically a good guy? Is he this Gorbachev figure who managed to help bring down a rotten system from within?
Well, it's true, you know, as Samira rightly points out, you know, we're talking about reconciliation here. It takes two sides to negotiate. If you don't have de Klerk in office at that time and that space, Is Mandela released? Are we where we are now? It's very easy and in many ways absolutely correct to look at Mandela as the hero of that era. However, it did take bold moves by de Klerk to make those moves possible. And whilst it's all too easy and accurate to talk about the evils of the apartheid regime, it did take both de Klerk and Mandela to come to an agreement to end that, to move forward. I think one of the great problems at the moment is, and we were talking about this idea of the state of South Africa at the moment is, you know, is it truly a democratic state when still, after all this time, the ANC is in power, there has been no turnover in government at this point. So I think we're going to have to see some interesting developments in South Africa, the least of which, quite frankly, is naming a street after one of the people who made the current situation possible.
It should be noted that the Cape Town local authority is in fact run by the Democratic Alliance, who are the ANC's primary opposition, and that ANC councillors were reportedly locked out of what was a fairly rancorous meeting. But it is also worth noting that among the people signing the motion endorsing this idea was Archbishop Desmond Tutu, no less. Is this possibly, Samira, do you think, just politics? Is it just the ANC's opposition trying to wind them up?
Possibly. I think whenever there's that sort of intense polarisation of politics and intense rivalries, I think that things get played up. But I don't think that it means that the grievances aren't real. I mean, de Klerk has made some quite controversial comments in recent years. I think he said not all of apartheid was bad. But he said like the sort of so you know, I think it's not an uncomplicated legacy, essentially.
Just, I guess, a final thought on this. James, should people want... Well, it's a stretch of highway, so I'm not really sure if it's going to be anyone's postal address, but should South Africans be happy living on a street named after F.W. de Klerk?
I wonder how many people in this country would like to be living on Margaret Thatcher Boulevard. You know, something quite similar. You know, whenever you name anything after a political leader, you're going to alienate 50% of the population, in very, very rare exceptions.
At the very, very least, I would think. James Boyes and Samira Shaka, we will have to leave it there. Thank you very much both for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vanuit Londen, Dit is Monocle 24. London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And there's loads still coming up in the second half of today's show. We'll be asking what the weeklies are saying in China. We'll be getting out our telescopes and looking across the Atlantic to a New York exhibition telling the story of Palestine's refugees since 1948. And we'll be reviewing the week's best in books. But ahead of all that, Paul Osborne has the headlines.
Officials in Jordan say they are ready to release an Iraqi terror suspect in return for a Jordanian pilot who is being held by Islamic State militants. But first, they want reassurances that Muaz al-Kassasbeh was still alive. He was captured last month when his plane crashed in Syria during a bombing raid targeting IS positions. In Malaysia, officials have formally declared the loss of a passenger jet almost a year ago to be an accident. 239 people were on board Malaysia Airlines Flight 370. It disappeared on a flight from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. Today's announcements cleared the way for compensation payments to their relatives. At least seven people have been killed and more than 50 others injured in an explosion at a maternity hospital in the west of Mexico City. Three of the victims are children. It happened when a gas truck blew up nearby. Rescue workers are now picking through the rubble as they search for survivors. And EU foreign ministers have been meeting in Brussels discussing whether to impose further sanctions on Russia over its role in the crisis in Ukraine. It follows last weekend's attack on the port of Mariupol, in which at least 30 people were killed. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Paul. Welcome back to Midori House. It's 21:32 near enough in Moscow, which will be 18:32 in London, 16:32 in Rio de Janeiro. It's time now to take our regular look at the weekly press from one part of the world. Today we're looking at one rather large market, that of China. A little earlier, Monocle's David Pleasant spoke to Patrick Bowler, freelance journalist and lecturer in journalism at the University of Hong Kong. Patrick started by talking about the response of the Chinese press to the Charlie Hebdo massacre in Paris earlier this month.
The Chinese reaction is very interesting because China itself has a Muslim minority in the far west, and there has been a growing confrontation between the majority Han and the minority Uyghurs. And so the state media have been very critical of Charlie Hebdo, and they've basically been saying that by being provocative, it was arrogant and it wouldn't understand other cultures and would be disrespectful to other cultures. So there was just this week, there's an interesting article in Southern People Weekly, which is a publication out of Guangdong, that actually tries to explain what Charlie Hebdo is without condemning it. So that's really something that you wouldn't expect, especially with all this public condemnation of Charlie Hebdo from Chinese state media.
And so a proper piece of investigative kind of reporting about another magazine in another country. Do you think it was a balanced approach? Do you think it kind of would have a good reaction amongst its readers?
Yes, exactly. That's what makes it so interesting, is that it is balanced. It's not judging. It's just laying down the facts of, you know, how Charlie Hebdo came about and what it was doing, what its intention was. And that is interesting also from another point of view, is that the Chinese readers are getting more and more interested in the world outside of China.
Okay, and let's go on to another publication, another weekly. This is Bloomberg Businessweek, a magazine that we are familiar with, but the Chinese version. And this is a particular focus on one city fairly near to Hong Kong. Tell us about this feature.
This is an interesting piece in Bloomberg Businessweek, the Chinese version, which publishes separate content from the English language version, which is speculating whether Shenzhen could become the Silicon Valley of China. And Shenzhen is, which is just across the border from Hong Kong, it's a city that's only about 30 years old, has become this fascinating place where there's a lot of startups, you see a lot of incubators, you see a lot of co-working spaces, And so it was basically looking at how Shenzhen has transformed itself of a place where you have manufacturing, outsourced manufacturing, to real innovation happening.
And just to dwell on the actual publication, Bloomberg Businessweek, the Chinese version, how does that differ? I mean, does it offer something a little bit different to its rivals, its other weekly magazine rivals? I mean, presumably the foreign kind of approach to the editorial, does that kind of make it stand out?
Well, yes, definitely. It does stand out in terms of the way it looks at stories isn't very... It's a very American way. The way the writing is and the design, you can feel that this is not the typical traditional Chinese publication. But it looks at Chinese enterprise business stories. So it's a great publication. And what it also does, it looks at Chinese companies going abroad and in the greater China region, which... So traditional Chinese publications don't have the resources to do that kind of reporting.
A more traditional or a very Chinese publication, the Kaiching magazine, they, as is traditional, as you've told us before, they like to focus on investigative, anti-corruption type journalism. And here is another case of that. Tell us what's in this week's issue.
Yes, that's correct. So Kaiching has a great report in this week's issue about Yang Weizhe, the former party secretary of Nanjing, being a former imperial capital, a major city in China. In this story, Cai Jing looks at his record, his track record as an official, as a civil servant. And so these kinds of articles could never appear, you know, they could never write such an article about an official that hasn't been purged. But so Yang was just purged earlier in January. So they're trying to look at his record, what he did right, what he did wrong. And it's a great narrative of how he rose and how he fell.
So it's interesting how Kaijing manages to do that. As you say, it's to some extent a mouthpiece in terms of what it's allowed to reveal and how it goes about investigating these corruption cases. But it's interesting that they choose to portray the kind of good side and the bad side of this official who's fallen from grace. Do you think there's balance in their reporting in that way?
I think so. I think this man, Yang was very much in favor of big infrastructure projects and doing big projects. So he got praised for bringing the metro network to a city where he worked in previously. And they're doing this with a purpose. What they're doing is they're basically laying down all the facts about this person they can write about. But officials who are in power now are reading this and they think, well, what if I fall? What if I am disgraced? There will be a record. These things will be looked at.
That was Patrick Bowler, freelance journalist and lecturer in journalism at the University of Hong Kong, discussing the weekly magazines out of China with Monocle's David Pleasant. You are listening to Midori House in Monocle 24, coming up for 1838 here in London. Up next, we'll be looking at a new exhibition in New York, putting the life of Palestine's refugees into sharp focus.
24/7, 28 programmes, up to 10 hours of speech a day. There's a glorious feast of Monocle 24 to savour. But when you want a slimming digest, fear not, we've got the curator. Premiering every Saturday and downloadable via monocle.com and at iTunes, it's a weekly roundup of the best from the week that was. Hours of audio output distilled into 1 hour of selected interviews, quirky dispatches and journalistic coups. Plus, here again, from the entrepreneurs, urbanists, architects, artists and culinary masterminds who made Monocle 24 special over the past 7 days. That's The Curator, here on Monocle 24, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and now to New York, where a new exhibition takes the viewer through the life and history of Palestinian refugees since that decisive year in the history of the Middle East, 1948. Through pictures and films from the archives of the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine refugees in the Near East, it draws attention to the agency's work in the region and to its human stories. The show is called The Long Journey, The Palestine Refugee Experience Since 1948. It's presented presented by Alwyn for the Arts and UNRWA USA. Abby Smardom is the Executive Director of UNRWA. There must be a better way to pronounce that acronym. She joins me now on the line. Abby, thanks for joining us. Introduce the long journey for us, if you would. What can visitors to the exhibition expect to see?
Yeah, well, first, thanks so much for having me. I'll start by saying UNRWA is the UN agency for Palestine refugees, and we provide education, healthcare, social services, and emergency protection to over 5 million Palestine refugees in the Middle East. We've been providing these services since 1950, and during that time, we've collected about 500,000 negatives, prints, slides, films, video cassettes, other images covering all aspects of the life and history of Palestine refugees from, like you said, 1948 to the present day. These are very rare images, and they've recently been recognized by UNESCO and have recently been digitized. So The Long Journey is a new exhibition that consists of a small selection of these images, and the photographs and videos include iconic images of Palestinians having to leave their homes in 1948, to the establishments of refugee camps in the 1950s, the second flight during the 1967 war, the war in Lebanon, the two intifadas, and even present-day images, including the iconic image that you might remember from the besieged Yarmouk camp in Syria last year. The lives of refugees are really central to the archive, often within the context of UNRWA's work. But there's also really beautiful and uplifting images as well, showing refugees going to school, participating in community activities, really making rich, meaningful lives for themselves. So the exhibition really covers really the whole aspect of life as a Palestine refugee, and it serves as the collective memory of Palestine.
So is there a particular reason why this exhibition is happening now? It is a story, as discussed, that dates back now more than 60 years, nearly 70.
Yeah, so, you know, the main impetus for this exhibition is that we've recently digitized all of the photos and videos for many, many years. Over 500,000 images were sitting in our warehouses in Gaza. So, you know, when we finally were given the opportunity and provided the funding, we've started to digitize all of them, and they've just been completed. So now it's going on actually a worldwide tour to really give individuals throughout the world a sense of what it's like to live the life of a Palestine refugee.
And when you say you're taking it on tour around the world, are you hoping that it's been my observation, having reported intermittently from the region and commented upon it from afar, that it's people's opinions about Israel and Palestine tend to be incredibly entrenched. Are you hoping to change people's minds?
Absolutely, absolutely. We're hoping that these images really can breathe life into the issue of Palestine refugees. You know, these refugees are not just numbers. They're individuals with rich lives, filled with heartbreak, but also hope. You know, they've been victimized quite a bit, but they're not victims. Palestine refugees have definitely contributed so much to this world while continuing to face political crisis after political crisis, and it's important for the public to see the multifaceted and complex lives of Palestine refugees to understand why they deserve our attention and our support.
I'd be interested to know what you think of it's an observation that's occurred to me. As I said, I've reported both from Gaza and the West Bank, though neither for a while now that I think of it. But I've occasionally been given to wonder, and some Palestinians have agreed with me, some obviously haven't, but that the continuing reinforcement of the idea of them as permanent refugees actually becomes quite damaging.
Sure. I mean, we certainly don't want that for refugees. We hope that they eventually do have the solution that they deserve to be able to live lives as they want to live in freedom and without fear of insecurity and the knowledge that they'll be safe and their children will be safe. In the meantime, it's very, very important for UNRWA to be there continuing to provide education, healthcare, social services, you know, because without them, there would be no services. So we certainly don't want this to be a permanent sort of way to handle things, but in the meantime, it's really important that those services are still being provided.
As I was saying there, and I'm sure you know this better than I do, people's opinions about that particular conflict are extremely entrenched and are extremely difficult to overcome. How difficult does that make UNRWA's work? How often do you find yourself just in the day-to-day business of trying to do what you do? And I have seen up close what UNRWA is doing, especially in Gaza. How difficult is it to carry on running up against the hostility that exists on both sides?
Sure. I mean, it can certainly be different. We often difficult. It can be hard because we get a lot of pushback sometimes. But ultimately, you know, once people understand the work that UNRWA is doing, that we're a non-political agency providing really life-saving critical services to people, I mean, this is an issue of human beings that need support. You know, take away the political side of things. See, this is 5 million people that deserve to have the same rights, the same freedoms, and the same services that anybody throughout the world would deserve. And usually once we can kind of get people to understand that, they start to come around and realize, okay, you know, these people do deserve our attention and they do deserve the support.
And going back to the exhibition itself, you mentioned this vast archive that had been sitting in warehouses for Gaza. I think you mentioned the figure of 500,000 images. How did you go about editing those down to an exhibition that people can take in? What story were you trying to tell?
Yeah, so that's a great question. It was our office in Jerusalem that really pared down the images to about 65 to 70 that they thought would really be a nice sort of snapshot of life as a Palestine refugee from 1948 to present day. They're broken down into decades and sort of political situations that they were taken around. And it, like I said, it's called The Long Journey, and it really shows the journey that these refugees have had to face, both heartbreaking and uplifting. But I think it gives people a really good sense of the various political situations that refugees have had to face and the various sort of more uplifting moments throughout the decades as well.
Does it suggest any evolution or, I guess, progress in the story? Because, again, it's something that struck me always as peculiarly heartbreaking when you talk to some 10 or 11-year-old kid on the West Bank or Gaza, and he talks about, when you ask him where his home is, he talks about a village in what is now Israel, a village which almost certainly doesn't even exist anymore, that not only has he never visited, but his father never visited, and possibly his grandfather has very little recollection of. Is there any sense presented in the photos that the idea of what being a refugee means has evolved to a more, I guess, positive seems like the wrong word, but I hope you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah, I do understand what you're saying, but I would say the answer is probably no. I mean, the most recent photo that you'll see in the collection is the photograph from Yarmouk camp in Syria last year, where you see thousands and thousands of people waiting for emergency food aid. If anything, it makes the situation look even more dire than it was in 1948, and for a lot of refugees it is. Certainly with everything that's going on in Gaza, trying to rebuild after this summer's crisis has been incredibly difficult, and now refugees there are facing horrible winter conditions in Syria, where 18,000 people remain trapped in Yarmouk camp. Many barely have any food, medicine necessary to survive. Protection issues in the West Bank are getting worse. So in a lot of ways, no, there isn't a more positive outlook, and the situation for Palestine refugees continues to be quite dire for many.
Abby Smardam, Executive Director of UNRWA USA, thank you very much for joining us. The Long Journey can be seen at Alwyn for the Arts in New York until February the 12th, when it culminates in an auction of photos. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. ...1848 or near enough to it in London. We'll be shortly taking a look at the latest literature with Granters and Meadows to take us there, some suitably literary pop. You may recognise this one. Kate Bush with Wuthering Heights, by way of setting an appropriately literary theme for our last item this evening on Midori House, which is our daily arts review. And today we are talking about books, the latest literature, etc., with Anne Meadows, editor at Granter, and Portobello Books, who passed on my last one, but I'm not going to hold that against her. We will start with a book by Miranda July. This is a novel, the First Bad Man, which it seems to be a sort of, I don't know, a modern dystopia. mixture, if you will.
Oh, that's interesting. I would have said it was a modern love story. It's very unorthodox.
It can be both.
It could be both. It doesn't have any of your classic dystopian elements. It's about a woman called Cheryl who's in her 40s and is very lonely. And she leads this kind of very enclosed existence. She doesn't have much in the way of friends. She's obsessed with an older man who ignores her and is having a distorted sexual relationship with a 16-year-old girl. And he's in his 60s.
This is sounding a barrel of laughs so far.
Well, this is the thing. It's one of the funniest books that I have read in the past few months. It's very witty, very sharp. July is a short story writer. And she's known for her kind of oddball comedy. And Cheryl, the narrator of this book, is about as oddball as you can get. And at the beginning of the novel, she's living this lonely life, and this woman, a young woman, a 19-year-old woman, moves in with her, and she's sexy and she's aggressive. And she and Cheryl start having these play fights. And the novel is kind of about their relationship. And it ends up being, like I said, an unorthodox love story.
What is it about Cheryl that we're supposed to, if not relate to, then at least buy into? Does she represent anything beyond herself?
That's an interesting question. She's lovable because she's so honest, I guess, because you have this interior voice. And I think in a way, she's not an obvious narrator. She's not the kind of narrator where she's making all of these great decisions or these great moves in her life. But in a way, her unlikability makes her likable. You know, I think there have been so many novels with female narrators where they're kind of passive or slightly foolish. Cheryl is smart. She knows what she wants, more or less. And her flaws make her.
Unlikability is a tough one, though, for an author to pull off. It happens a lot with, and not that I'm suggesting it's anything similar, but the thing that popped into my head, it was the problem I had with the much acclaimed TV series Mad Men. I got about three episodes in and just thought, all these people are awful. I wish the building would burn down. How does Miranda July manage to sustain interest in a character who you say, as you say, is flawed and not necessarily terribly likable?
She does it partly just by sheer momentum. Like this is a novel where you have no idea where it's going. I mean, in a way, I've already revealed too much, but you start it and it's so strange and it's so feverish that you kind of just get pulled along. It's a bit like someone like A.M. Holmes, who also has a lot of unlikable narrators in that sense. She wrote this book, Will Save Your Life. You're reading and you're laughing and you relate to the momentum and the speed of it as much as anything. But it's not, I mean, Cheryl is not a bad person. Mad Men is arguably filled with horrible men. And the first bad man does have this one central bad man who you loathe. But Cheryl herself is, she's top class.
So you're recommending this one, basically?
Definitely. I mean, if you're into funny fiction, if you want to laugh, if you want to be taken away from the world you're in, then yes, The First Bad Man.
That's The First Bad Man by Miranda July. I want to move along now to 10:04 by Ben Lerner. His first novel, Leaving the Atocha Station, was much ballyhooed a few years ago. The difficult second novel?
Well, this is a difficult second novel about writing a difficult second novel. It begins with the narrator, who is called Ben, getting an extraordinarily large advance for his second novel.
I wonder where he gets these ideas from.
Yeah, precisely. And so it's a book about writing a novel. It's about this character, Ben, who is clearly in some ways related to Ben Lerner, and he has a terrible medical condition, and he's living in Brooklyn, and he's trying to make art, and he has a best friend who is very keen to get pregnant, and he agrees to help her. So it's a difficult follow-up novel about a difficult follow-up novel, but because of that preoccupation with art and artistry and what does it mean to try and create fiction when we're living in these crazy times, you know, of intense privilege, but also environmental disaster on the horizon. And, you know, how do you keep the novel going? And this is a solution.
Does he sustain that, though? Because when you get into any situation of making art about art, the potential for rendering yourself and your work completely insufferable is huge. I mean, that's one of my favourite books of last year was the, if I got his name right, Laurent Benet's HHHH, in which he wrote a fantastic historical fiction interleaved with various agonising about the point of writing historical historical fiction. And I turned every page of that thinking, okay, this is where he's going to start annoying me. But it never quite happened. Does Ben Lerner sustain the conceit in 1004?
I think so. I mean, there will be people who find this book insufferable, and there'll be people who find it precocious, and there'll be people who are frankly throwing it across the room. But I think that his intellect and his use of language, I mean, he's first and foremost a poet, and the prose in this is lucid and sparkling and precise, and his ideas are just above and beyond what most people ever managed to achieve. So it's a thinking person's book, but it's all the better for it.
We should look finally and unfortunately extremely briefly at Elena Ferrante's Those Who Leave and Those Who Stay. If you could sum that up, its sort of flaws and its and its good points in about 15 seconds, that would be brilliant.
Wow. Okay. Elena Ferrante, I read 4 of her novels last year. There's going to become a point where if you're not reading Elena Ferrante, it's going to be like not having read Flaubert in 1856. She's probably the best European writer writing today. So she's incontrovertibly brilliant.
Okay, that's a fairly unambiguous recommendation. Anne Meadows from Granta and Portobello, thank you very much for joining us. That is all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks to our special guests earlier in the show, Samira Shackle and James Boyes. Today's show was produced by Alice Block, research by David Pleasant and Alia Massoud. Our studio manager was Bill Lutie. Up after the headlines, 1900 London is The Urbanist, presented by Andrew Tuck. At 2200, I'm back for The Daily with Nancy Durham. Midori House returns, also hosted by me, you lucky people, at 1800 London. And time tomorrow, but for this edition, it's goodbye and thanks for listening.